Okay, so again, the factual scenario here, the defendant's employee is pushing somebody, trying to help them get into the train car before it pulls out. And this action by itself, we could say, was not the action of a reasonably prudent person, that the employee, using reasonable care, would have said, wait for the next train, or have handled it in a different way. As a consequence of this sort of pushing and shoving, these fireworks fall out of the guy's possession. They fall, they explode. Then what happens? Right, and so the people who talk about Paul's graph refer jokingly to the scales falling on her eyes instead of the scales falling from her eyes. But in any event, you've got these scales that fall down on her. She's injured, and she wants to blame the railroad for causing her injury. Okay, so those are the basic facts. What is Cardozo's analysis of the case? Okay. So if Cardozo were categorizing this case, where in my casebook it would fall, what chapter would this case fall into according to Cardozo? Chapter 1. This is a case about negligence. And as you say, Cardozo's view of the case is that there is no negligence. Now, let's be clear about the fact that with respect to the passengers on the train, suppose one of them had been injured in, let's say that the railroad employee was kind of throwing this guy on the train and he stumbles and lands on somebody or causes injury to somebody on the train, and they say, hey, you negligent railroad, you didn't use reasonable care, you threw this guy on me, and I want compensation. Would Cardozo be willing to allow a jury to find negligence in that case and to impose liability on the railroad for that act? I disagree. Ms. Williams, you're nodding your head, yes, why? Well, let's not talk about Mrs. Paulsgraf for just a moment here. Go ahead. The question is, on what basis could Cardozo say that the people on the train could sue the railroad because... Okay. Same act is negligent, but you used a word earlier that's very important to Cardozo. Why is it that Cardozo says there's no liability here? Well, we could do a Chapter 2 analysis here about causation. But remember, Cardozo wants to say this is really about Chapter 1. Why not? Why isn't there any negligence with respect to Mrs. Paulsgraf? Yes, that's the word foreseeability. Notice that what Cardozo is saying is that negligence depends upon a finding that the injury was foreseeable. It is foreseeable if you're manhandling the passengers on the train and throwing them around that one of them is going to land on somebody else and hurt them. Because that is foreseeable, the reasonable person would use care to try to avoid that. If you fail to use reasonable care, you're negligent, you can be held liable. Why can't we say that act is negligent with respect to Mrs. Paul's graph? Because Cardozo says that an injury to Mrs. Paul's graph is not foreseeable. Again, this is why I entitled this section The Unforeseeable Plaintiff. It's not that injury isn't foreseeable. It's that injury to this particular plaintiff is not foreseeable. And Cardozo says, unless you make a finding that the injury to this particular plaintiff was foreseeable, you don't owe that person a duty. If you don't owe that person a duty, you can't breach that duty. If you can't breach a duty, you can't be found negligent. End of story. Now, who are the people, according to Cardozo, to whom a duty is owed? Okay, in this particular case, but more generally, Cardozo says that as I wander through this world, I owe a duty of care to whom? Okay, but as I make decisions, as I drive my car, as I walk down the street, as I swing my golf club, as I do things in life, to whom do I owe a duty of care, according to Cardozo? Mr. Phillips. And he has a name for that, for this area, as it were. What's that? Or zone of danger, as it's sometimes called. So what Cardozo imagines, and this is metaphorical to some significant extent, it's not literal, physical, but it's metaphorical that there is a zone of danger out there to which the eye of reasonable vigilance extends. He says, reasonable people take precautions as to those persons or as to those things where the eye of reasonable vigilance would perceive a potential risk. As Cardozo says, if I'm just walking down the street and I see a pile of newspapers, would a reasonable person take care to walk carefully through that pile of newspapers on the street? Not unless there's some reason to perceive that there's danger in walking on them. They're just newspapers on the ground. What do I care? What does anybody else care? I got better things to do with my time. If, however, I had some reason to think that explosives were being wrapped in newspaper and where I saw a pile of newspaper on the ground, I had reason. A reasonable person would be on guard against the potential that by kicking that pile of newspapers, I would set off an explosion. Well, then a reasonable person would take precautions, but not otherwise. So according to Cardozo, again, one of his phrases, which he quotes from somebody else, that negligence in the air, so to speak, will not do. You can't speak about something being negligent in the abstract. Cardozo says all allegations of negligence, all claims for negligence have to be, in effect, person-specific. If you say, was this act negligent, you have to be able to answer the question, with reference to whom? Was it negligence with reference to the people on the train? Yeah, could be negligent. Got to talk about that. But that's a playable game. Negligent with reference to Mrs. Paulsgraf? I don't think so. How would the eye of reasonable vigilance deciding whether to help these people on this train, how would such a person anticipate that their behavior would put Mrs. Paulsgraf at risk? Eye of reasonable vigilance couldn't perceive that. Therefore, says Cardozo, you have no business calling the defendant negligent for failing to exercise reasonable care with respect to someone they had no reason to think was at risk. Now, the other or another angle of this is that the question about whether somebody owes a duty of care as distinguished from whether they breached that duty of care is considered to be a question of law for the court. Deciding on the existence of a legal duty is thought to be a legal question as distinguished from a factual question about whether such a duty was breached. Now, here I have to do a little apologia as to why I teach this class the way I do. Namely, I start out not talking about duty, breach, causation, damages. I start out talking about breach of duty. One word. Rather than separately identifying a duty of care. The reason I do this is because the question about whether a duty is owed usually doesn't feature in the problem. If you've got a medical malpractice case, an intersection collision, a product liability claim, a slip and fall, what have you, it rarely is the question, did the defendant owe the plaintiff a duty? It turns out to be an exceedingly difficult question, one fraught with all sorts of hard questions about legal policy and so forth. We tackle some of those in Chapter 11 after we've been through a whole bunch of other stuff and we're kind of ready to take on this more difficult question. For the moment, I'm more content to say, can you identify a negligent act? But here, I'm reminded of the fact that my skipping over that question comes at a cost, because Cardozo takes up this question. Did the defendant owe the plaintiff a duty of care? Now, notice again that nobody's really challenging the idea that the defendant owed somebody a duty to use reasonable care. The only question is whether we can say that the defendant owed Mrs. Paulsgraf a duty. And Cardozo says, I get to ask that question, I get to answer it, I say no, she loses. Now, Andrews thinks this problem needs to be analyzed in a different way. As I think I said yesterday, it's not so much that Andrews gives a different answer to the same question. Andrews thinks that the majority asked the wrong question. And although he doesn't directly address the question, I think it's clear from the way he analyzes the case that he thinks there is such a thing as negligence in the air. If I'm carrying a bunch of stuff through that door, carrying on a conversation, and in pushing my way through the door between 11:50 and 12 o'clock, not watching where I'm going, you would say, well, that's negligent. The risk of injury from my, you know, or if I'm driving down the road talking on my cell phone and reading the newspaper and carrying on a conversation with somebody in the back seat, meanwhile driving 10 miles an hour above the speed limit, you say, well, that's negligent. You can look at somebody's behavior and evaluate whether their conduct is reasonable or not without ever asking the question Cardozo thinks we have to ask, namely, relevant to whom? You can look at it by itself, but Andrews, and I want to, the other thing I want to emphasize is that while Andrews and Cardozo have very important, in some ways, very fundamental differences, they agree on a very crucial part of this question, which is, they agree there are limits to liability. Both Cardozo and Andrews are trying to identify the difference between the type of claims the tort system ought to recognize, the guy who negligently tosses somebody onto a train and injures somebody in that process. Everybody agrees that's within the bailiwick of the tort system. They also agree that there comes some point at which we say, no, tort liability doesn't extend that far. But the point is that they have a different method for drawing that line, because they ask a different question, and they ask the question of a different body or different functional entity within the legal system. Where does Andrews locate the question for this case? Yes, he says this is not a Chapter 1 question. He doesn't quite refer to my torts book, but if he had that in mind, he would say this is not about Chapter 1, this is about Chapter 2. Why is it a question about proximate cause? Okay, what Andrew says is that, in effect, what you have instead of a zone of danger for purposes of saying these people are inside the zone of danger to whom a duty of care is owed, those people are outside the zone of... He doesn't want to mess with the zone of danger stuff, but he still has a somewhat spatial metaphor here. He refers to these metaphors of causation as though it were they were links in a chain. We refer to this metaphor of the chain of causation. At some point, this chain sort of breaks or can't sort of hold. The chain can't be extended that far. Or the other metaphor he uses is the idea that you drop a pebble in the pool and you watch these ripples radiate out from the initial act, and at some point they dissipate. You can trace their effects to a certain point, and then they sort of fade into the rest of what's going on out there. So that from the defendant's negligent act, you sort of look at radiating levels of causation. And this may have... He also clearly distinguishes between things which are causes. He says a cause, yes, but not a... Well, he uses the... I wish he'd said a cause, yes, but not a proximate cause. He says, yes, a cause, but not the proximate cause. I think the emphasis is on a different syllable there, namely, that it's the emphasis is on proximate cause. where is this? Okay. Yeah, on the top of page 64, that left-hand column, first full paragraph. Again, describing something which starts and then radiates out. He says a cause, yes, but not the proximate cause. And again, as you said earlier, he would not disagree, I don't believe, with the idea that there may be multiple proximate causes of an injury. But again, Cardozo's engaged in the same effort to say, from the defendant's act to the plaintiff's injury, can we trace a causal relationship such that we can fairly say the defendant proximately caused her injury? So again, Andrew sees this as an issue not about who's negligent or whether somebody is negligent, or the anterior question to that, did the defendant owe the plaintiff a duty? Cardozo doesn't think that's a useful question. He does, however, think it's a very useful question to answer whether or not the defendant's negligence proximately caused the plaintiff's injury. If it didn't, legal liability shouldn't be extended to the plaintiff. Even if you can say that the defendant defendant's negligence was a cause of the injury. He says that's not enough. But for causation is not enough. It has to be, in addition, a proximate cause. Yeah. Right. For example, the fan who interfered with Moises Alou's attempt to catch the ball last night, you know, how far will the effects of that extend? You know, suppose the Cubs wind up losing the game tonight and Chicago goes into a total tailspin as a result. There are riots in the street. Could we fairly blame, you know, and then so forth and so on? Yeah, okay, all right. The ardent Cubs fans would say, string him up by his thumbs. Okay. But again, you know, the question is, everybody, Andrews included, see, it's not as though Cardozo is this narrow-minded curmudgeon who only, you know, who's doling out liability by the teaspoonful, whereas Andrews is, you know, Santa Claus who wants to let everybody celebrate here. There are differences in terminology, in metaphor, but Andrews also thinks there need to be limits to liability. But one of the critical questions for Andrews is, who makes that call? The jury. Andrews thinks this is a matter not of grand legal philosophy. He says this is a matter of practical judgment. It's almost a matter of taste here. And again, you see the kind of contrast between Cardozo's anxiety that if we let this thing loose, we're going to have hell to pay. We have to keep a tight control over the extent to which the tort system is enforcing duties on people to watch out for other folks. Andrews doesn't think that's a problem. Andrews says over and over again, this is not a matter of grand philosophy. This is a matter of, you know, kind of whatever floats your boat here. Okay, so same page on 64 here, but the right-hand column where he says at the end of that that first paragraph here. This is rather rhetoric than law. There is in truth little to guide us other than common sense. So to the extent, again, that Cardozo was saying, no, this is a matter of principle, not a matter of common sense, can't trust it to juries, it's got to be controlled, Andrew says, I disagree. It's a matter of common sense. Now, he says, there are some hints that will help us. Again, I would prefer that he said a proximate cause, but can't be too fussy here. Involved as it may be with many other causes, see, he does say that, many other causes. Okay, maybe at least something without which the event would not happen. What's that? What's something without which the event would not happen? That's but-for cause. So, again, Andrews is incorporating, it's got to be a but-for cause, but beyond that, he says, the court must ask itself whether there was a natural and continuous sequence between cause and effect. Well, that sounds like the pattern jury instruction we've been hearing. Was the one a substantial factor in producing the other? That's the substantial factor test. Was there a direct connection without too many intervening causes? Is the effect of cause on result not too attenuated? Have we stretched this chain of causation so far that it's really going to snap at some point? Is the cause of the usual judgment of mankind likely to produce the result? Again, this is sort of the increased risk doctrine. Look at how rich this paragraph is. By the exercise of prudent foresight, could the result be foreseen? Now, notice here that Andrews is agreeing with Cardozo that foreseeability is important. But whereas Cardozo says foreseeability is the cat's meow, it is the be-all and end-all. It's either foreseeable and there's a duty of care, or it's not foreseeable and there's no duty of care. Andrew says, hey, it's something you just kind of throw in the mix there. Roll it around, see what you think. Is the result too remote from the cause? And here we consider remoteness in time and space. Again, practical judgment. We draw on, at the end of that paragraph here, we draw an uncertain and wavering line, but draw it we must as best we can. It's all a question of fair judgment. We endeavor to make a rule that's practical and in keeping with the general understanding of mankind. And elsewhere, I can't put my finger on it right now, he says, same page, but going back, the left-hand column, about 10 lines from there, or 8 lines from the top, this is not logic, it is practical politics. It's a rough sense of justice. The law arbitrarily draws a line. So again, Andrews is saying, don't look for some grand theory here. Eyeball each case, make what you think is a fair judgment, move on. That's life. And again, Cardozo is anxious that this is way too loosey-goosey a standard for his taste. And again, this reflects a kind of common theme in the law of the extent to which you want to have a clearly articulated, bright, principled, abstract rule, or whether you say, we'll try to give you some guidelines, but don't let those guidelines be too rigidly enforced. Handle each case as you think best comports with your intuitive judgment about what's right and wrong. And if it's inconsistent with something else, so be it. Life's like that. Now, again, it's not to say that either of these perspectives is right or wrong, but they do reflect a tension of attitudes about the law, and in particular in this point in our legal history, whatever the year of this is, 1928, when there are a lot of changes in society. There's industrialization. You're close to the beginning of the stock market crash and the Great Depression and the World War and all that sort of stuff. At which people are jockeying, in effect, for the position to explain what it is that we do when we make law or enforce law or interpret law. Yeah. Yes, but one says we should follow one path, and the other says we should follow a different path. Now, the choice of the path doesn't dictate the outcome. It's not as though when we go down Cardozo's path, the defendant wins. When we go down Andrew's path, the plaintiff wins. But you look at the case differently. And the best way to illustrate that, really, is to talk about Kinsman Transit, because that's, here's a case in which you get to try out, in effect, your theory of what method we should use in figuring out which plaintiffs get to recover and which plaintiffs we say, sorry, you're not within the list of, you're not on the guest list here. Mr. Phillips. Well, you could always say, you could have had the case come out the same way simply by saying the standard is as Justice Andrews describes it, but of course reasonable juries can only enter verdicts, or a judge may only enter judgment on a verdict where the verdict is one which reasonable minds could have reached. I look at the evidence in this case, no reasonable jury could have found that this negligence proximately caused her injury. Andrews had the right standard, but of course, juries can't do whatever they feel like. Juries can only do those things which we, in a supervisory capacity, find are reasonable. On the other hand, I'm not sure how you would reach that conclusion. If Andrews has given you this kind of, it's like saying, find the best house for you in Spokane. Find the best faculty member for Gonzaga Law School. What are the criteria that we use? Well, yeah, it's nice if people, if you're looking at houses, you can say, well, how close is it to shopping and to schools and the neighborhood and traffic? You could have 17 different criteria, all of which are important. And if I say this is the best house for me in Spokane, it's pretty hard to say, oh, no, that's wrong. The way Andrews has set the problem up, how does an appellate court say jury was clearly wrong here? Jury couldn't possibly find that this negligence proximately caused that. Because the criteria are so flexible. Yeah. Well, the place where he got off the trolley, so to speak, is that he never found a duty. Well, then he would say the jury gets to, the jury gets to follow that trail wherever it logically leads. If they find there's a duty of care and they find that these people, for example, suppose there's a rule book that says, when a train is less than 2 minutes from departure, people trying to get on the train should be you know, told to wait for the next train. Do not help people on the train if it's less than 2 minutes before its scheduled departure time. Guy clearly broke the rule. You know, easy to find that they were negligent, assuming Cardozo would have agreed that they owed a duty of care to Mrs. Palsgraf. But obviously he never got there. That's the point where he cut it off. Mr. Breck? Yeah, that's an easy one, because the duty of care is owed to such a person. The eye of reasonable vigilance, throwing passengers around on trains, could see that you could hurt somebody in this neighborhood if you carelessly throw somebody on the train. Right. Well, that's his whole point about saying this action may be negligent vis-a-vis the other people in the neighborhood, but it was not negligent vis-a-vis Mrs. Palsgraf. Because before you say it's negligent vis-a-vis Mrs. Palsgraf, you have to show that a duty of care was owed to Mrs. Palsgraf, and that in turn, backing up in the logical chain, requires us to say that we, the eye of reasonable vigilance, could perceive a danger as to Mrs. Palsgraf. And he says that simply isn't true. Absolutely. See, but Andrews, again, doesn't go toe-to-toe with Cardozo on the negligence question. Andrews says, as I've said before, so critical in virtually any major debate about, you name the topic, some pot-burning, controversial issue, the question is, how do you define the question? And so Andrew says the question is not whether these people were negligent. I don't think that's a tough question. What he did, violated the company rules. It's negligent, but the question you want to ask, says Andrews, is, but did it proximately cause Mrs. Palsgraf's injury? I think that's an interesting question, says Andrews. But let's see about how we would answer that question about proximate cause. So where he disagrees with Cardozo again is, what question are we asking? Cardozo says the question we ought to be asking is about negligence. And Andrews says, I don't think that's the right question. Yes. Yes, but that may be a relatively easy case. And remember, the scenario here is, again, if you're kind of diagramming each of these causation problems, so I have a kind of paradigm in my mind to see if my facts fit one or more of these paradigms, this is the Palsgraf paradigm. Defendant does some negligent act, toward A, shoves people on the train, or ties up an ore boat along the Buffalo River negligently. There's an identified group of victims of that negligence, but through a strange series of Rube Goldberg-type coincidences, B over here gets injured. The Palsgraf question is, can the defendant be held liable for an injury to B when the reason he should have used reasonable care was not because I was worried about B, I should have been worried, perhaps I was worried about A. Is that enough to get us to liability to B? And again, what Cardozo says is, evaluate the negligence question based on whether the defendant could reasonably foresee B as a potential victim. If so, duty of care is owed. If not, no duty of care, no negligence. Next question, please. Again, in many of these kinds of cases, Andrews says, I'm going to prove negligence here. That's the easy part. And in fact, Cardozo might concede, well, if you look just at the defendant in A, it was negligent. But that's not what we're talking about, says Cardozo. The question is whether they were negligent toward B. And again, Andrews says, no, wait a second. You just conceded, Cardozo, that this guy was negligent, but now you got to answer the question, did it proximately cause the injury to B? And here's, you know, there's a lot to talk about as to whether or not you can call this a proximate cause of that, but we're talking Chapter 2, aren't we, says Andrews. Again, shifting the terms of the debate by saying, let's ask a different question. It's negligence in the air, which Cardozo dismisses. You know, who'd be interested in negligence in the air? Well, that's a ridiculous idea. Andrews doesn't directly address it, but it's not negligence in the air. It's the act was negligent. Why can't we just call it that? It's not in the air. It's just there. Okay, now, again, the point of this exercise is in part to see how much fun you can have with this, why it is that legal scholars care so desperately about Paul's Gap, because it's such an interesting case, sociologically, historically, otherwise. But for purposes of the practicing tort lawyer, you want to first be able to identify those cases in which I may have an easy case of negligence toward one person, but I've got a more remote plaintiff out there, and they're going to have a tougher time establishing the basis of liability. And depending on whether we're talking Cardozo's method or we're talking Andrew's method, we either identify the problem in Chapter 1 and start talking about foreseeability and the duty of care, Cardozo, or we identify it as a Chapter 2 problem and we talk about it in terms of whether it's a proximate cause, whether the negligence was a proximate cause of the other injury. Is Ma? No. And again, it turns out, this is not terribly relevant, but it turns out that Washington declares itself to be a Cardozo-type jurisdiction. It says, what does it say? Foreseeability is not the handmaiden of proximate cause. This is a turn of phrase in the court's opinions in Washington. So in Washington, it is for a judge to decide in cases like this whether a duty of care was owed. By contrast, if we were in an Andrews-type jurisdiction, the judge would be more expected to hand the question over to the jury and say, ladies and gentlemen, if you find there's a natural and continuous sequence between the defendant's negligence and the plaintiff's injury, you should call that a proximate cause. But if not, don't. It's up to you. So again, Andrews puts the primary responsibility on the jury. Cardozo says the buck stops here on the bench with the judge. So let's take a good look at Kinsman on Monday and wrap this up here.